How can you achieve and maintain business growth? Harvard Business School Executive Education is now accepting applications for a new program, Driving Profitable Growth. Taking place in Boston from October 25th through the 28th, this program focuses on business expansion and organizational growth strategies that can lead your company into the future. Learn more about this three-day program for senior leaders by visiting hbs.me/growth. That's hbs.me/growth.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily podcast on the Oklahoma City Thunder, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello there, everyone. We're locked in for episode 238 of Locked On Thunder, presented by the Norman Transcript. I'm your host, Fred Katz. Locked On Thunder is part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Head onto iTunes, search Locked On Thunder, subscribe to the podcast there. Leave a review once you're on that page. The reviews really help in the rankings. Leaving 5 stars helps in the rankings too, but the reviews are really they really help us. So it's always nice if you leave those if you have something nice to say. And you can find us on audioboom.com too. A little bit of an interesting episode this time. Not your usual Locked On Thunder episode. We do talk about the Thunder a little bit. We do talk about Paul George, but I've got Greg Sestero on from the movie The Room. Not Room, The Room. Tommy Wiseau's The Room. It's a cult classic. If you're unaware of it, it's really one of my favorite movies of all time, and I've seen it about 500 times. It's known as the Citizen Kane of bad movies. Really, the worst movie ever made, and it's, in my opinion, really the best. It is so enjoyable. It's so funny. It's a cult classic. I really think I can't recommend it enough to people who haven't seen it. There are going to be spoilers. I spoke to Greg for a while. Greg plays Mark in The Room, Tommy Wiseau's character's best friend. If you've seen the movie, you would certainly recognize him. And Greg has a book, which he wrote about the making of the movie. We talk a lot about the making of the movie, the behind-the-scenes stuff, his perspective, his friendship with Tommy. And then his book is being adapted into a movie right now with James Franco, which comes out in December. So he came on. He wanted to talk about the movie. I've known Greg for like a long time, and we became friends after I was already a fan of the movie. And he's a huge, huge, huge basketball fan, a huge Lakers fan, a great guy, and he's got a great sense of humor about the making of this movie. And I think I can't recommend this movie enough if you haven't seen it. And if you have, I think you're going to enjoy it. If you if you're one of the crazy cult fans like me of this movie, I think you're going to enjoy this. Name of the movie and the book, by the way, same names. I assume if you're already listening, if you're still listening to this point, then you're probably a fan. But the name of the book and the movie, both The Disaster Artist, so you can look those up. I spoke to Greg for about an hour about a little bit of Paul George talk, a little bit of Warriors talk at the top. And then just talking about The Room and Tommy and all that stuff. So I'm going to splice right into that conversation right now. Enjoy.
You are Locked On Thunder, your daily Oklahoma City Thunder podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hey, so this is a podcast I'm really excited about. I'm here with Greg Sestero of Patch Adams. Patch Adams fame, right?
Yeah, that's right. My my big supporting role.
More importantly, Greg. More importantly, Greg played Mark in The Room. There will be spoilers in this podcast. We are going to talk about The Room. And if you haven't seen The Room, like, what are you doing? You got to see The Room. Greg is also the author of the book, The Disaster Artist, about the making of The Room, and it's being adapted into a movie now. Greg, what's going on?
Not too much. Glad to finally be on here with you.
I know. How long have we been talking about like doing a podcast together and just talking about basketball and The Room?
Quite a while. I mean, I think when we started, the Warriors were lucky to be in the second round of the playoffs. That's how long.
Yeah, it was like the Mark Jackson era.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's the beauty of this.
It was when they lost to the Spurs, I think, in the second round, right around that time. At that point, I kind of thought the Warriors had peaked in a way. Like, I thought that's where they were going to stay, but obviously that changed dramatically.
Yeah, well, that last year, they lost to the Clippers in the first round. And it looked like and a Clippers-Warriors rivalry kind of started. Like, the Clippers are still the last Western Conference team to beat the Warriors in a playoff series, which is kind of funny to think about with the way that those two teams and the directions those two teams went after that series. But the Clippers beat them in that playoff series, and it was kind of like, okay, this looks like it could potentially be the Clippers' time. The following year, I think, was that Clippers Spurs playoff series where it looked like, okay, this is the Clippers' time. And it looked like it could have been the Clippers over that time, and then the Warriors were the ones who busted out. Like, if you asked me during that time which one of those two teams was going to be one that would potentially win the Western Conference, like, in 2014, I was guessing the Clippers over the Warriors.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it was that Game 7 where Blake Griffin made that incredible play and did that flip, and you just could kind of feel that the Warriors were heading backwards somewhat, and then they fired Mark Jackson, and you figure, okay, it's gonna totally shift now, and they're going to become irrelevant. And then they hired Steve Kerr, and then I remember I went to a preseason game where they played the Lakers in, like, September of 2014, and I couldn't believe how good they looked in that first quarter. I mean, they were a totally different team. Their ball movement, they looked incredible. And I just thought, whoa, I can't believe this is the Warriors. Like, they weren't just a three-point shooting team. I remember Bogut making great passes, and they're getting a lot of dunks. And then they just went on a tear. They were unstoppable. And then they went on and won. So I don't think I've ever seen a team – everybody got better over that summer when the change was made. Every player became better. Like, I didn't notice Draymond Green as much, and all of a sudden he just became a force right after that. So I think, obviously I think the coaching change shifted the culture, but I just think everybody on the team plays really well together, and they all want to get better, and they do get better. So it was stunning to see them just completely dominate the Clippers ever since that Game 7 loss.
You lived in San Fran when you were making The Room. Like, how long were you in San Francisco for?
You mean when we were filming The Room, or?
Well, because you were living there for a little bit, right?
Yeah. I'm from the Bay Area originally.
So how'd you end up a Lakers fan?
When I moved to LA, I was always a big Phil Jackson fan. And so when he took over the Lakers, I just started following them more, and then I just got swept up in their culture. And it was a really exciting time starting, in 1998, 1999. It was always interesting, they won those titles, and then Phil left, and then it was really interesting to see him come back and have to deal with the team that had Smush Parker and Kwame Brown, and to see what he was going to do with that team, because he had always usually coached big players, and at that point all he had was Kobe. And so it was a great time, because you got to watch them at their peak with Shaq and then have to rebuild. So it was fascinating to see what Phil Jackson could do with both those teams.
When you were in LA, so not you mentioned it, 1999, you're in LA, right? Was that right? 99, you said?
Correct.
Yeah. So 99, you're in LA. You're living in Tommy Wiseau's apartment then, right?
Yep. I watched a lot of Laker games in that apartment.
can you describe that apartment for me?
Yeah, it was right in the heart of Hollywood, and it was, I'd liken it to a lair. We had, black curtains up separating half the apartment, and it was like a little movie set from the Addams Family. But luckily there was a TV with a few antennas where you could catch some scribbled games on there. If there was like a Sunday morning ABC game or something, you could watch that. Kind of dark, not too much light, but when you're 22, I think you wouldn't expect anything less.
In your book, you wrote about Tommy, and you wrote about that apartment. And like, I would love, and for those who haven't seen Greg's book, who are fans of The Room, it's called The Disaster Artist. It's about the making of the movie. You've known Tommy since what year? 1998.
Yeah, we met in an acting class in San Francisco in 1998.
Okay, so during the first time you meet Tommy, how did you describe it? You said that he read a Shakespearean sonnet, right?
Yeah, he performed a Shakespearean sonnet in front of the class, and we all knew we had just witnessed something very special. it was life-changing watching that, because after I saw his performance, I just thought, forget about acting, I just want to know who this guy is.
So what, like, I feel like there are two reactions that people can have to Tommy, and I feel like people who have seen the movie, and like I've, you know, The Room is like, you know, my obsession with this movie. Like, I've seen it like a gazillion times, like so many times, to the point that I just sit there kind of like, it's like when you're at a rock and roll concert and, you know, you see the Stones and you're just, you know, you're just singing along with, you know, their hit songs. Like, that's what it's like when I watch The Room. I just mouth the words along with to the movie when I'm watching it. I'm just mouthing along, "You're tearing me apart, Lisa," as it's going on. And what I feel like there are two reactions to have to Tommy. You can either be like totally pushed away, be like, what the hell is going on? And that kind of happens with people when they see the movie at the very beginning at first. Because the question that you always ask is like, wait, is this a porno? What's going on? and so you can kind of be pushed away, or you can just be like so intrigued. And I feel like it's different when you have that reaction when you're watching somebody through a screen. Like, when you have that reaction when you're watching the movie, it's a little different than when you see that guy in person and you're just like, I have to hang out with this person. So what is it about you that gave you the reaction to where I'm sure there were people in your class who were like, oh my God, please, can we get to the next person? Like, what was it about you that was not only like, I want to see this guy act, it was like, I have to become this guy's partner and then I just have to make him part of my life?
He made me laugh. There was just something hypnotic about the way he spoke, the way he interacted with the teacher. There were no rules really. It was liberating to watch somebody go up in a class and just, you know, not to quote the movie, but tear it apart. And I was a little bit more reserved, and a lot of the actors in that class were, you were watching an acting class, so it wasn't entertaining, but when Tommy went up there, it was entertaining. You were watching a performance performance art in a different way. And I got kind of tired of the acting class and trying to get everything perfect. I liked what I saw, and I was like, hey, this looks fun. Maybe if I partner up with this guy. And also, you know, you got to remember, I was at a very low point because I was living in San Francisco. I was trying to move to LA, and back then, you know, you needed tape, you needed an agent. It was a lot tougher than it is now in a lot of ways. So I just missed out on getting this part that was shooting up here with Eric Roberts and Daryl Hannah at the time. And so I figured, what do I have to lose? This guy seems like a character. Maybe I'll have a good week of rehearsing and I'll forget my troubles, and it ended up totally changing everything for me.
So, Greg, I want to let you know, I'm not just saying this because I'm like having you on and because we're buddies. Like, I'm going to tell the listeners now, if you're a fan of The Room, and I assume if you're listening this far into the podcast, you're a fan of The Room, because this is not a Thunder podcast. This is just us talking about The Room with like some spliced in hoops talk. But if you're a fan of The Room and you haven't read Greg's book, you should really read it. And the way that I described it to you, which is the way that I'll describe it now, which is there are really very few jokes in your book, like very few jokes, but it is the funniest damn book ever written. Like, it is the funniest thing. I'm laughing on every single page. Somehow, the making of The Room is more entertaining than The Room. Like, I don't know how that's possible, but the making of the movie is incredible the way put together. So I needed to plug your book because it's and you know what, the audiobook version too, with your impression of Tommy, your like incredible impression of Tommy is pretty great too. So either of those, like, if you're a fan of the movie, you will you'll enjoy the book. That's my plug for you. That you're getting the organic plug. It's the genuine organic plug. When this is going through, like you're making the movie? I think it was in 2003 when it came out. When did it start being made? Like 2002 or 2003?
We started making it in the summer of 2002.
So summer of 2002. Or maybe a little bit after, fall 2002, winter 2002 into 2003. Are you thinking, what is your mindset? Do you know at that point, like, I should write a book about this? At what point do you think, like, I got it? Because the book doesn't come out till, 12 years later or something. So at what point do you think, oh my God, I have to write about this experience. People are going to want to hear this.
So I made The Room, and at that point, I didn't expect, really anybody to see it. It was, it's hard to get a lot of films seen, even if it's got big names in it. And so really, to start, it was me helping out a friend make his project, because Tommy was taking on a pretty big task of making a feature film, financing it, producing it, starring in it. He was going to need help. And I figured, he asked me several times, and I figured, okay, I can help him. And then eventually I was in it, but that's it. I thought maybe he would release it on DVD at some point, or but he went all out. He had a premiere, he put up a billboard that stayed up for 5 years in Hollywood, which I don't think has ever been done before. So initially I never expected to write a book, because there was no audience for it. But as it started building up this cult, and then all of a sudden now you had celebrities and comedians that love this thing. And it started over the next 5 to 7 years, it built up this LA culture, and everybody started knowing about it and talking about it. And then it started spreading. And so by 2009, I did a few appearances with Tommy, and I couldn't believe what this movie had turned into. We were at the Ziegfeld Theater in New York in 2010. There were 1,200 people just shouting, chanting through the entire film. And I get all these questions about, what was it like to make this movie? What did you think? And I would tell people, if you knew the story behind the making of this movie and the story behind Tommy and my friendship, it's even nuttier than the film. And there was no way for me to really explain it. And so I sat down and I started interviewing Tommy about what was his life like before trying to become an actor, before we met. And I realized that we had a lot in common in that way, that we both were kind of trying to tackle this impossible dream at different points in our life. And we somehow met in this class, and then we ended up coming together and then making this thing, which, ended up achieving success for very different reasons. So there was so much to the story than just the making of a bad movie, that I thought this could be a great story. And not only that, my goal with the book initially was to have that be a film movie. And I remember I told a few people early on that my goal with this was that this book was going to become the next Ed Wood movie. And they're like, okay, a book about a movie, and then a movie about a book about a movie. And they just thought, things really out there. So it's just the last 7 or 8 years has been just kind of watching the impossible slowly take place, which has been really, really fascinating.
So we'll plug the movie now too, right? Let's talk about the movie a little bit, because that's a big deal. What is The Disaster Artist comes out. What's the date again?
It comes out December 1st. It's being distributed by A24, the guy, incredible studio that did Moonlight, Ex Machina, Room, ironically, the other Room.
They did Room too. Extremely different movies.
Yeah, they tackle really fascinating projects, and so to have them behind The Disaster Artist is pretty exciting.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a great cast. I mean, it's James Franco, and you're played by Dave Franco, is that right? And
correct, yeah.
Yeah, and trailer's out. Trailer's really funny. It's Franco playing Tommy Wiseau and going through all the takes of I did not hit her, I did not.
And it is a really, really, really good trailer, which I think people, fans of the room will get. And that tape you said in the book, that scene with the "I did not hit her," that you said that was 32 takes or something, right? For him to just get that down?
Yeah, Tommy has a very special way of performing, and I think that scene is such a favorite just because of the way he acts. You know, I mean, I think you could try to recreate that scene, or you could have the best director in the world, and just something about that scene, it hits the home run for a various amount of reasons. But it kind of goes back to the acting class that, you know, there's just something authentic and original about Tommy, about the way he operates. And then that's what's kind of given us such great stories and material throughout the years.
How often?
James.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Go ahead, Greg.
Oh, yeah. So I was going to say, James Franco, he plays Tommy. And I got a chance to see an advanced cut of it almost a year ago. And I truly think that James Franco's performance as Tommy is one of the best performances I've seen in the last 10 years. It's to be able to watch this film and see someone play someone that I've known now for almost 20 years and actually feel like I'm watching them on screen. I mean, there's moments in the film where James as Tommy is walking, approaching a scene, and it literally looks like you're watching Tommy, the mannerisms and everything. So the casting, the way that the film was directed and the way the story was told is fantastic. And so it's been a really exciting process.
So how often when you're sitting down at Starbucks or you're walking down the street, or I guess you live in LA, so no one walks down the street. You're in wherever the hell you are, where someone could approach you. How often do you get approached by some stranger who you've never seen before in your life coming up to you and saying, "Oh, hi, Mark"?
You know, it's happened more and more in the most random spots.
What's your weirdest being approached story?
I was sitting in a restaurant that was practically empty. It was like, you know, a nice upscale restaurant. There was nobody in there. It was just me and a friend. And you can see through, it was glass. And so someone walks in, and I thought that's kind of weird. There's nobody else in here. And they come up to me and they're like, "Are you Greg Sestero from The Room?" And I was in the middle of nowhere. And they knew all about the movie. They knew all about the book. And I remember it took me a few moments to realize, okay, was that set up? Was I punked or something? It was so random that someone, you know, really in the middle of nowhere was able to walk by this restaurant enough to see me and know the film. And also another random time was I was on a bus in London. I was lost looking at a map, and this guy sitting across from me asked, you know, "Are you Greg Sestero?" So it's very, very random how far this movie has spread. And it still amazes me all the time that people actually know this movie.
Do you have a favorite part of it? I mean, I feel like everyone's kind of got their favorite part. Like to me, my, you know, everyone's got, every people know the moments, the "I did not hit her," "You're tearing me apart." And like people, I feel like "You're tearing me apart" has kind of been, I know people who are actors who use "You're tearing me apart" as like the terminology on sets and stuff, or when like a director will tell them like, that's a "You're tearing me apart" moment for a signal for when someone's overacting. That's just like a code for overacting now. And I know everyone's got like their own favorite scene. To me, the most underrated is Tommy's chicken impression. I just love the chip, 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 chip. I love it. I think it's so funny. Do you have like a favorite? Cause you got to look at it differently, right? Like you're there, you're shooting it. You obviously were extremely conscious of what this was going to end up being in terms of like, you know, the final outcome when you're making this. I mean, it's clear from that everybody making it was, you know, I mean, the book is literally called The Disaster Artist. Like, it's clear people have that perspective. People weren't fooled into thinking this was going to be a major thing. As a matter of fact, you give off the impression that people are surprised by you know, how it ended turning into a huge cult success. So what, from your perspective, is something that you really enjoy in the movie?
You know what? I've always loved the alley scene where the guy gets pushed down into the trash can. There's just, it's simple, and the dialogue, like, what I think is, the things I like about The Room is when it's just operating and trying to be a group of normal dudes hanging out, having a conversation, because if you just listen in and observe, that's where I think the comedy is. And so you have this guy walking down an alley, he's approached about this underwear story, they toss the football around, and the dude ends up getting thrown in the trash can. That scene to me never gets old. I think it's perfect.
Why does he get thrown? What's his name again? The Me Underwears guy. What's his name?
Mike.
Mike. Why does Mike get thrown in the, like, what is the direction that is given to, okay, now throw him into the trash can at just the end of this extremely normal conversation, just have this non sequitur throwing into the trash can? Like, what's being told in order to have that happen?
It was just in the script that you toss the, hand the football to him and he falls down and hurts his leg. So
it's so great.
That's one of the reactions anytime I've shown a friend over the years. That's the scene that always kind of gets the biggest laugh.
Really? That's interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah, that's a really good one. You brought up football. Let's talk about football. Are you a good? I know you're a huge sports fan. Are you a good athlete?
Yeah, I'm a huge football fan as well.
Okay, so I know you mentioned a little bit in The Disaster Artist, like kicking around a soccer ball with Tommy, and like you kind of introduced him to throwing a football. And I know, like, on the director's cut or whatever on the DVD, he says, like, the reason that people are randomly throwing a football an extremely short distance is because he wants to show, like, you can play football anywhere. You can just throw around a football wherever you want. It's 6 feet and it doesn't matter. It's just fun to throw a football around. What's wrong with that? And do you think there's another reason why it was incorporated into the movie? Because, like, you mentioned that he mentioned a similar thing about kicking a soccer ball with you, like in casual conversation, like before the movie was even like a thing that existed. Is there a reason why Tommy has that perspective on kicking a soccer ball around or throwing a football that nobody else has?
I think it's just, you know, he sees that as connecting and what buddies do, you know, something that's, I guess he would say it's free and easy to do. You could do it anywhere. So that's just what two bros would do, I guess, on a sunny afternoon in San Francisco.
How did this, cause I know like at one point you say that, like when Tommy, I'm trying to remember the exact scene that you set. It was like in a car. And Tommy was yelling at you for asking questions about his background because he's obviously very, very secretive. And you said something along the lines of, like, Tommy, was this the reason you started to question, like, is this the reason why Tommy and you were friends? Because you didn't really ask questions. You were, I think you said, a non-security risk or whatever it was. But now, like, you've written a book. You've told as much of his story as you could possibly tell. You guys obviously still have a good relationship. So at what point did that attitude start to change to where you kind of reached for you shifted from like, well, I don't really ask questions to now I'm going to tell people.
You know, obviously The Room developed a cult. Obviously The Room developed a cult audience. And so therefore Tommy, you know, got out there, went to a lot of different cities and, you know, so he's been asked a lot of questions about things. And so really my goal with the book was just to share the craziness of this journey and, you know, just reveal and stuff that I interviewed him about his journey, you know, coming to San Francisco and living in New Orleans for a bit. So just stuff that would add to this story and not so much as like a investigative journalist type thing, but really just kind of be able to let him tell his story in his own words and what I experienced. So, you know, I think there's stuff that Tommy doesn't like about the making of the room. But I think at the end of the day, he realizes that, you know, my intention was really to bring light, not to mock the situation or the making of the movie, but really just to show what it's like to try to pursue your dream when the odds are against you and maybe you're not exactly cut out for what you're trying to be, and persevering and ultimately getting a piece of that. So I think Tommy realizes that my intentions were good in telling the story.
Can we get to some conspiracy stuff? Can we do this? I want to get your theories. Okay. I know he says he's from New Orleans. Where do you think Tommy's from? Because you can give the best educated guess on this than of anyone.
Well, he said, yeah, New Orleans or Mars. So I think maybe somewhere in between.
Like the moon.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things that I've always found interesting, that what has not only made the room interesting, but what has made Tommy's persona interesting is that, you know, there's a lot of answers we don't have. And I think that's kind of a good thing because there's so much we know now in general that it's kind of nice to be able to guess or wonder or have your own opinion on what this is all about. And so I don't know, you know, how he's done it, but he's kept himself very, you know, very private and mysterious. And I think that's what adds to a lot of this phenomenon is that you don't have the answers or all of the answers. And I think, you know, my goal with the book was to give a few answers, but then pose more questions. So the cycle just kind of keeps going.
Well, it's certainly what makes him such an intriguing character, because like what makes the room so attractive is that the characters in the movie, like that are written in the script, are not the only actual characters. Like in some ways, like the main character in the movie, and I think this is probably, and tell me if you think I'm wrong, I think it's probably intentional, but in some ways the main character in the movie isn't Johnny, it's Tommy himself. Like Tommy somehow became a character even as an actor playing a character in that movie, you know what I mean? And it's part of what, like, his presence and his existence and, like, his background. And the more, like, the room becomes more enjoyable when you know things about it. Like, once you don't, like, I didn't notice the spoons on my own. You know, someone, like, my buddy who showed it to me tells me, like, oh, watch for the spoon photo. And that's like a thing that like makes it more enjoyable when you know the background, you know the room culture, and you know a little bit more about Tommy as a person. It becomes like 10 times more enjoyable. You know what I mean? So I feel like the intrigue of Tommy and not necessarily knowing those things about him, it turns him, he doesn't have to be an endearing character, but he is absolutely in my mind an endearing character. If he weren't, I don't think it would be nearly as successful. Like, You laugh when you watch it, but there's something that you like about him, you know? And it's hard to put a finger on it. And I feel like all like that mystery kind of adds to all of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally agree.
But he doesn't have to be someone, because like you write about it, he has his abrasive moments, and you know, obviously there were people on the set who were disgruntled. A lot of people quit. A lot of people were fired. Like, he doesn't have to be this endearing character. And yet somehow he really is. I can't really put my finger on it about what it is, but I like him. What is it? Like, what is it that makes it so? Cause you have that moment where you see him in the acting class and you're like, I gotta get to know this guy. So like, what is it about him that kind of pushes him towards that likability, even though there's just not another person in the world like him?
I think to me, I was always drawn to like the childish enthusiasm, the aspect that there's like a freedom there because he won't judge you, you know, if you walk in and you're dressed horribly and you're having a bad hair day or something. Like, he would be amused by it rather than judge you. And so I think it's that kind of that aspect of freedom and his enthusiasm about the simple things that almost becomes contagious. And I think he carried through with the making of the movie, you know, each scene, things were important to him that maybe other people wouldn't have cared about, and that's what makes the movie unique in its own way.
Why was Tommy so infatuated with you early? I mean, you're a good guy, Greg, but why was he, like, what was it? Because I totally get it. You see Tommy and you're like, I just gotta get to know this guy. Like, I have to see what the hell is going on here. But it seems like he chose you too. So, and like he wanted, like, it wasn't just, you know, you were a line producer at first in the movie, and then he's like, no, you're going to play Mark. I need you to play Mark. I need you in the movie. I need you doing this. He wants you right there next to him, it seems like, in everything that he does. So why does he have that connection to you? I get yours to him, but what drew him to you?
I think when he saw me throw a football, he knew that there was something special.
Perfect spiral.
I think it kind of goes back, you know, to me probably feeling that, you know, maybe my acceptance, you know, I always saw kind of the positive parts of Tommy. And I think the fact that I was very accepting and never really, you know, was intruding on what he was trying to do. I thought, you know, it's great that he's, you know, people might judge him a certain way as him trying to become an actor. And I was like, no, I think you have everything it takes. And I think you're actually really great in your own way. And I think no one had really treated him that way. And so I think there was a sense of trust there that maybe he hadn't experienced and vice versa. So it was a very bizarre pairing and a very bizarre meeting. But I think when you're in a world that is lonely, you know, I think when you do find kind of that connection and that understanding, you know, you cling to it.
So,
you know, it's a little bit like, you know, it's not that much different than being on a team that's kind of unraveling and you connect with a teammate, and, you know, that can take you a long way when you have that trust in a dysfunctional environment.
When was the last time you spoke to this acting teacher that you, in the class that you met Tommy at?
It's been pretty much since I left for LA. So it's been a very long time. I think I was trying to get back in touch with her and visit her. Tommy and I were going to go visit her because I think she'd be pretty stoked to know everything that's happened. And Melanie Griffith actually portrays her in the film in a couple scenes. So I thought that'd be something she might be excited to hear about.
I mean, she's gotta know about the room and all of this, right? Like, she has to.
Yeah, she does. Her daughters, I think, took over the school, so they all know very much about it. So, yeah, I mean, she's gotta be up in her mid-80s at this point, but I think we still owe her a visit.
I would love to know her reaction.
Thanks for teaching us how to act. I'm sure that's going to be high on your resume. Hopefully she can appreciate it in the right way.
I mean, I feel like when you're far enough removed from that, like, how could you not? I mean, what's not to appreciate? Here's the thing. It's just so damn entertaining that, like, even, like, when I showed it to my father, who is in his late 60s, and we are of, obviously, by definition, different generations and have different, I mean, I'm very close with my father, but we have extremely different, you know, tastes in movies and all that in, like, entertainment and that stuff. And, like, the only two things that we watch together, if we ever really watch something, is we'll watch, like, political TV or we'll watch, you know, a baseball game. And those are the two things that we share in terms of just our entertainment. And other than that, like, there isn't much overlap between the two of us. And I first time I showed him The Room, I really wanted to show it to him. And he was, like, totally, not down to watch. He was just like, this is not, I sold it on him the way you would sell it to someone. And he just was not down to watch it. And he watched it. And I got him and my mom to watch it together. And they both just loved it. And I feel like there's something that is, there's something that people just really enjoy about it. They like genuinely makes people, it just makes people laugh. And I feel like somebody, no matter what your connection is to it, like there's something that you can appreciate in it. So I she's got to be happy about it. I refuse to believe she's not. I don't want to live in a world where she's not.
I'm sure if she experienced it in a theater and saw how much people enjoyed it, that might sway her a little bit.
Am I being too much of an optimist here? I feel like you're calling me too much of an optimist right now.
No, I think, I mean, at the end of the day, I think she'd be happy that, you know, we tried to make something. I think that's better than never trying at all. But I think the movie really does come alive with a group of people, I would think, more so than someone watching it alone, you know, at home. So there's a comedic art to it when you watch it with a group. It just... It comes alive in a different way. So maybe she would see it more there. But you know, at the end of the day, I think she'd be happy.
So one of the themes in like the making of the movie is Tommy's kind of Pennywise pound foolish strategies, where you know he shoots it on HD and SD cameras that he purchased instead of rented. But then he doesn't want to pay for air conditioning, or doesn't want to get water for the crew, or, you know, doesn't want to get a line producer when you're still in the movie and he doesn't have a full-time, you know, line producer who's just doing that, or whatever it is. I mean, there are a lot of examples. And what I kind of think is so interesting about it, which will lead me to this question, is part of the spending, the outrageous spending, is that which you already mentioned, that billboard was up in L.A. for 5 years. And culturally, that added to some of the intrigue of the movie, because people would drive by that and be like, what is this thing that's up all the time? And I don't live in L.A. I've never lived in L.A. I've been to L.A. I've never lived in L.A. Did that end up making a huge difference, do you think, that billboard just adding to the intrigue and the culture surrounding the movie and kind of helped it take off just because it was there for so long? Like, in the end, if that was something that helped the movie take off, Was the overspending not actually overspending?
Well, yeah, it definitely is part of the mystique now of the movie. And I know being up for 5 years, so many people saw it and talked about it. And I'm sure it did draw quite a few people to actually go see the film. I remember, I think it was David Cross or one of those comedians that ultimately saw that thing so many times that he's like, what the hell is that thing? I gotta go see what it is. And I think it spread even more. But I think it just makes for a great story. It's kind of par for the course that everything was done very differently. You know, as Tommy would say, he doesn't like the cookie cutter from Hollywood. He likes to do things his own way. So, you know, I don't know if you can put a number on exactly what that billboard did for it all, but it stayed true to that method. And I think over time, it's something that'll be key for the phenomenon.
How's Tommy feel about all this? Like, how does he feel about now, you know, the movie kind of taking off and the book and now your book and now The Disaster Artist becoming a movie with major actors? Like, how, because when he's making the movie, he thinks he's making the next Citizen Kane. And it becomes a popular movie, and it becomes like my favorite movie ever. But it for a different type of reason. Like, and so many people watch it in that sense now. So like, how does he feel about the public attitude towards The Room and towards the fact that like it's probably going to become even more popular because people are going to see like, oh, James Franco is making a movie about this, and I don't know. I don't know if the movie is structured this way, but it's got to be the sense where, you know, if you've seen The Room, I'm sure you're going to enjoy The Disaster Artist, the movie, more. So I'm sure more, you know, that's going to be great advertising for The Room. Like, more people who hadn't seen The Room are going to go see The Room because this movie is coming out, and they're gonna see it under the prism of the way that James Franco is making this, and the way that you tell the story in the book, and the way that they've adapted it to the movie, and all of that. And I'm just wondering, like, Tommy, who was putting this together and thought that he was putting together, you know, the next Citizen Kane, and then it turned into, you know, this type of culture. How does he feel about all this?
You know what? I'm not exactly sure. I know that he is happy with the response Room got overall, and that people love it and people are still seeing it 14 years later. So I think, you know, that's exciting for him. I'm sure for any filmmaker. And I think he's, you know, at peace with that for the most part.
That is, you got to get him on this podcast, Greg. You got to make that happen.
Yeah, you would have a field day with that.
Oh my God, I'd be so happy. I would be, you have no idea how happy I would be if that could happen. I wouldn't let him leave. He'd be on, I would just let him, he should have his own podcast, honestly. Just let him, I don't care what it's about. It could be about cooking. It could be about him watching and reviewing a different movie every episode. It could just be him talking about whatever his day was. I could just describe the most mundane day, and I would 100% listen to every single episode. I don't care. It could just be a ton of live reads, just him doing like SeatGeek ads the entire time. And like,
it would, that is a great idea, a Tommy podcast. That would be great.
It would be awesome. You know what I should do? I just want him to read my SeatGeek ad for an episode. Like, just have him splice in, read an advertisement. He can do it however he wants to do it, and then just get out. And I'd be so happy. If he had a podcast, man, it would be so good. Him interviewing people, just anything. I don't care. I don't care what it is. I would listen to every single second of it. It would be fantastic.
It's a great idea, man. I'm not going to lie. I'm surprised I haven't thought of that.
So, get it to him. I don't care about taking credit. All I want is just for it to happen. That's really all I care about. So, if I told you, so like, it's 2003, and I tell you, like, you're going through this, you know, this kind of horror of making the movie, and it just finishes, and you know it's not going to be, you know it's not going to win an Academy Award. And if I tell you this movie is going to be, it's going to get you a book deal. It's going to be turned into a movie with James Franco. Although I don't know if James Franco was big in 2003, so maybe that's not such a big deal. But with many famous actors and many famous people and many successful people putting it together, and it's going to be a big deal. What's your reaction, like, as the movie is going on?
I would have thought it's the biggest lie ever, because there was just simply no way. Actually, you know what? James had just done Spider-Man in 2002. So Tommy and I very much knew James at that time. He also played James Dean, I think, in 2001. So,
right. And you guys love James Dean. Is that part of something? Cause I know you're a James Dean fan, and Tommy was a James Dean fan. Is that anything that, like, led to an attraction to James Franco, or was that totally a coincidence?
I'd always liked James Franco, but I think that was just, it happened to, it's a strange coincidence because, you know, James had played James Dean, and now he's playing Tommy, which I thought... And James won a Golden Globe for playing James Dean. So, good. It's a really good connection. But no, I would have never thought, I mean, writing a book about this and then it's kind of stuff that it's fantasy land. There's no way that stuff could, you know, ever happen. And in that moment, there's no way you could have foreseen that.
So, were you excited when we're shifting for a sec? Because I want to get your take. And I haven't asked you this. Really should ask you this, but I haven't. Were you excited when Paul George got traded to the Thunder as a Lakers fan? Like, how pumped were you? And how are you feeling about this tampering investigation?
You know, I thought that it's great that Russell Westbrook's going to have somebody like Paul George to play with, because, you know, Russell Westbrook is, I think, right now in the NBA, the most dynamic player. I mean, he's somebody you admire, because every time he steps on that court, you know, he's got the most energy and of anybody playing, and doesn't shut down, doesn't back down. So watching what he did last year was just, you hadn't seen a season like that by somebody in a long time. And so to get somebody now like Paul George to team up with him, I think, is going to be great. I mean, I did think that Thunder team from a couple years ago that lost to the Warriors in seven, I thought they were the better team that year. I mean, I thought had they just made a few more shots in game six, that they may have won the finals. So I really did like that Thunder team a lot, and I think Paul George, it's going to be a lot of fun to see how those guys play together, because I haven't seen too much of Paul George. I remember he was really great in that 2013 conference finals against the Heat at the time. I thought he showed a lot of skill. So, but about for the Lakers, yeah, I don't know. Who knows about that? Who knows about that tampering stuff?
Right.
I know.
I don't think much is going to happen from the tampering thing. I don't think it's going to end up being a big deal in the long run.
I think they do have a big plan. The Lakers have a big plan of what they're going to do in the next couple years. I'm not sure what exactly it's going to be. I know that they'll definitely be better next year, which isn't really that tough. I know they've had the worst stretch in the last few years, but they always find a way to bounce back and get a really exciting team on the court. So they were good for so long. And, you know, just those last few years, a few things went wrong. I mean, had they gotten Chris Paul in that trade, you know, they would have stayed. They would have basically been the Clippers, but the Lakers version of the last few years. So they still would have been competitive, I'm sure. But, yeah, I think they'll be back, you know, really strong in a couple of years. But I don't know how anybody is going to get past the Warriors in the next few years, because I think the Warriors got better this year. This offseason.
Yeah, I actually agree with you. Bringing in Caspi was a nice signing for them. He's going to be good for them. He's going to legit contribute. He's going to be really good this year because he's perfect for that offense. So he's going to be really good this year. People are going to be like, how the hell did Omri Caspi go for so low? I think it was Zach Lowe who said that, and like I totally agree. He's really going to be a legit role player for them. He's going to be good, and I feel like they're going to harness the good in Nick Young, because there is good. He's skilled. He's a really good shooter. And I feel like
he's going to be a more controlled version. He's going to probably be more productive. And I think last year at the end of last season, they went like 27-1, the Warriors did. I mean, so they ended up becoming the team where the year before, where they went 24-0, they flipped that and got stronger at the end, and I think it's because Durant had a full season to fit in, and I think they're going to come out this year even better because Durant's had a year to play with them. And they were, you know, the finals. I mean, you had Kyrie and LeBron just going off, and they just gave everything they had, and they still, you know, came up short in those few games. So I don't know. I don't think I've seen a team that has, because you know you have the big three multiple places, but this team is legitimately four incredible players. It's just, yeah, it's going to be tough to bring them down without an injury. I think they're going to be really tough to beat. You know, I know Houston got better. I just don't see how you can solve those four guys playing at this level unselfishly. It's going to be a big challenge. And now, you know, I can't believe the whole Cleveland thing. That was a stunner, because I really got a chance to watch Kyrie this finals. And I mean, they can go into the basket. I don't feel like I've seen someone that's that great and that creative, and the way he uses the glass and just make shots happen. So it was kind of a fun team to watch grow in Cleveland. And so now that's all changed. So yeah. I mean, this off season, wouldn't you agree? It's probably been one of the craziest ones ever.
Oh yeah. 100%. It's been nuts all the way down to the fact that like we had to wait till August 22nd for the biggest trade of the off season, like with the Kyrie Isaiah Thomas deal. Like that's a massive trade, and that should be like the one thing that happens, you know. But there's so much. I mean, there's just so much drama in the NBA, and there's really like we say off season, and it's technically the off season, but there is no more off season in the NBA. Like it is always basketball season now. Like it's really, I say it's 11 months, but a trade just went down on like August is the 1 month off, but like a trade just went down at the end of August. So it's like 11 and a half month season now. It's amazing. You get 2 weeks off in the beginning of September and that's it. That's when the NBA isn't really in swing. Yeah. And the training camp starts.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. When I heard about Paul George going to OKC, that was probably one of the biggest surprises, just because everyone had kept saying he's going to Cleveland, he's going to the Lakers. And then going to OKC, I thought was actually, they needed that. So that's really exciting. Now, do you think he's going to stay there? Or do you think he'll have a good season? Or
what are your thoughts on that? No. I mean, if they like have an unexpectedly incredible season, then he could do it. Maybe. If it's like a really incredible season and everything goes right and they make a really long playoff run and it's just a thing that he and Russ want to stay together or something like that. But my guess is no, I don't think he's going to be in OKC. And I think that's fine. I mean, I think the Thunder made the trade with the anticipation that he would not be here in 2018-19. And I think if he leaves, they would still make that trade 100 times out of 100. And I would agree.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you have to make that trade 100 times out of 100.
You got to see what at least give them a shot. And did the Thunder pick up any 3-point shooting?
They got Patterson. They got Patrick Patterson. And they're going to play Alex Abrines more. And they're going to play Alex Abrines more. So okay. And they're going to play McDermott more too. They're not going to be a good shooting team, but they were last in 3-point shooting last year. And they'll be better this year. You know who Paul George's agent is? You know who he's represented by?
No.
CAA, who received the greatest letter in the history of letters. Tommy Wiseau ending a letter to CAA with just not even really asking them to take him, right? Just kind of telling them they should take him. And ending it with, "Do you have the guts to take me?" I love that so much. That is the most confident thing I've ever heard. That is like the J.R. Smith move of letters. Like that is it is such just throwing your balls on the table move. Like it is awesome. I love that so much. It makes me love that guy.
Yeah, it's taking a half court shot to try to win the game.
Right. It's taking a half-court shot to try to win the game when it's like a tie game. And there's like still like 13 seconds left. That's what it is.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think they didn't have the guts to take him. But now I think it's evened out a little bit. So.
Oh, they should have. They messed up big time. I love that. So, Greg, what did I leave out? What do you want to – anything you want to tell people again before – Before we go, you want to give the details in the movie or something, in the book, in your book, and where people can find you and all that?
Yeah, so the Disaster Artist movie comes out nationwide December 8th. And even if you haven't seen The Room, it's really a terrific film for a lot of reasons, and it's something that you can just go into and enjoy the story. You don't need to have seen The Room to get it. It's kind of a combination of Boogie Nights and Ed Wood, which were two very good films about Hollywood, about friendship, about weirdos. And and if you dig all that stuff, Tommy and I got together and we made another film for the first time since The Room, something that I never thought would materialize, but we made another film. It's called Best Friends. It's going to come out next year. So if you've enjoyed The Room and you've enjoyed The Disaster Artist, there'll be a third film for you to enjoy sometime later next year. So it's, in between obsessing over sports, filmmaking and writing is my other passion. So, and I try to include sports in everything that I do. So there is a hidden sports moment in the new film as well. So, and it includes basketball.
I'm very excited for that one. Needless to say, I'm going to be seeing that. Well, I'm going to be seeing both of them. Greg, I really appreciate you, you coming on. I'm glad we finally did this, man. We've been talking about doing this for such a long time. I'm glad it finally happened.
Yeah, definitely. No, me too. It's been a crazy few years, so it's good that, we're catching this right before everything starts to go down.
Yeah, well, I'm honored that I'm sure you're going to be doing a lot of promotional stuff, as the release date approaches and everything. And I am honored to be part of, probably one of the millions of people that you're going to get to talk to. You remember, this was a special episode. Obviously, it'll be out Friday afternoon. Normally, I'm just on Tuesdays and Thursdays and talking Thunder. And you can head to iTunes, subscribe to Locked On Thunder there. Questions, comments. You can email lockedonthunder@gmail.com. Find me on Twitter @FredKatz. And Greg, you're on Twitter too. Where can what's your handle again?
Just Greg Sestero.
Greg Sestero. There you go. Sestero. And you can find my work, normantranscript.com/sports/thunderroad. I will be back on Tuesday. Greg, thanks again, man.
Thanks, guys. We'll do this. We'll do this again when the Thunder go to the conference finals.
There we go. If the Thunder go to the conference finals, then I am going to have you on again.
Okay.
That's the deal. You just locked yourself into that.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Back Tuesday. Until then, Locked On Thunder is locking up.